Blog Talk Radio.
Watching you as you're dreaming, the dreams I thought I knew. Your smile shows the reason I watched it all come true. Your touch is cold and distant, and I still loving you. I'm walking down
December 19th, 1918. An up-and-coming cartoonist, entrepreneur, and amateur anthropologist was about ready to make history as his first ever comic was being published in the publication The New York Globe. This man was a world traveler, and he was attracted to the oddities of human society and this world. His name was Leroy Robert Ripley, and what he founded on December 19th, 1918 was Ripley's Believe It or Not. In his honor and the celebration of the 105th anniversary of this comic strip, we present to you Deranged December, where we will be talking about some of the oddest crimes and crime stories in the history of the world, the modern world, I should say. We start in 1911 with a train robber who traveled around more after he was dead than alive. We go into 1922 with the Queen of Los Angeles as she kept her lover in the attic. We then go to 1933 Bronx, New York, where a man just wouldn't die. In 1957, the odd tale of a Halloween gone wrong. And then in 1987, the sad, sad story of the boy in the wall. All of these will be part of Deranged December on Murder and Mayhem, believe it or not. I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight, and I want to give a special thanks out to the AP Taylor Foundation for supporting and taking care of a team of voices. I want to thank pretty much everybody who out there who gives us a support. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of my gaming buddies. I said I'd do this. They'd be listening in, Obi and Carrie the Killer. I want to welcome into the room my co-host for the night, Sweet Pea. Hello, Sweet.
Hello. I'm sorry it was so last minute. It was over at a memorial service or a memorial show for SS poet here on All Poetry that recently passed. So it was over there and came right as running as fast as I could over here to this wonderful show. I'm very excited about, you know, Deranged December. I love that title, by the way. You got some great things coming up. Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. These stories are absolutely wild. And let us introduce, let us bring, who is on Skype here?
I believe it might be Raconteur.
Raconteur, is that you?
Well, I just smell dust and decay.
Hey, brother. How you doing?
I'm all right. What's going on?
Not much. We got Deranged December here, so we're going to have a little fun talking over some stories and reading a few poems, but we're doing this in honor of the 105th anniversary of Ripley's Believe It or Not, which is coming up on December 19th. So this is part one of a part two Deranged December that we're going to be enjoying.
Awesome.
Oh, and Jay, you always have a special guest on your show, but he doesn't really say anything. My husband's a former police officer, and he loves these shows, so he generally sits next to me and listens.
That is awesome. Awesome. Well, I'm going to start it off here with a very interesting story. This is a story of Elmer McCurdy. Now, good old Elmer was alive back in – he was born in 1880, and he joined the military after he was part of, he had a slight military career for the United States Army back in 1907 to 1910. After he got out, he decided to turn to a life of crime and become a train robber and a bank robber. Well, he was kind of klutzy at it. The whole thing about it, he went ahead and in the military, they said he worked with ordnance and bomb disposal and such and creating explosions. But in his good old-fashioned way, when he tried to rob his first ever train back on March 24th, 1911, it was the Iron Mountain, Missouri Pacific train number 104. And one of the cars contained a safe with $4,000, which back then was quite a bit of money. Now, what he did is, as they got the train stopped, they went to blow up the train, and he was using nitroglycerin. Now, the problem with this is he used too much, and he blew up the safe. to the point where all of the paper notes inside, all of the bank notes were burnt up, and the silver money inside the safe actually fused itself and melted to the metal of the safe. So he was kind of one of these train robbers that really, really wasn't that good of a criminal. Now, so they pretty much ended up having to, let's say, rob the people. And then on September 1911, they decided to rob a bank in Chautauqua, Kansas. Now, once again, he used nitroglycerin, but he again used too much. He blew the door off of the bank vault and destroyed everything inside the vault. They ended up stealing $150 in coins. That's all they got out of that whole thing. And lastly, they one more train in October, and he heard that it contained $400,000 in cash. So they went ahead and stopped the train, and they found out that they were stealing the wrong train. It didn't have any money. They robbed all the people. They got a total of $46, and it was called the smallest it was called the least profitable train robbery in American history. So
that's
but
awesome.
soon after this, they went ahead and formed a posse to go after him. And what happened is he ended up in a shootout, and they ended up shooting him and killing Elmer. Elmer, the mortuary owner, which was common in that day, went ahead and mummified his body and put him in the display case in the front window to kind of deter future criminals. Well, the whole thing about it is he was one of the last train robbers in the Wild West. So soon after, he wasn't needed up there anymore. But, hey, he was up there. So the owner of the mortuary used to sell tickets to get to see him and get pictures taken with him. Soon after this, a gentleman came up and told the mortuary guy that he was Elmer McCurdy's brother and to let him have the body. Now, what happened was that mortuary owner finally allowed him to have the body, but later it was revealed that it was not his brother, but instead an owner of a circus sideshow. And he put Elmer McCurdy's mummified body into the sideshow, and for years and years, his body was at sideshows all over the place. You know, he died in 1911, but he was kept up like crazy, and he went to different places in South Dakota, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And from there, he was sold to the Pike. He ended up at the Pike, which was a amusement park in Long Beach, California. He was put in the Funhouse for a while, and after a while, he was put in storage. Now, what happened is in December 8th, 1976, the production crew for the television show, The $6 Million Man, was actually filming scenes at the Pike when they went in back and were moving around what they thought was a wax mannequin hanging from a gallows. But what happened is the mannequin's arm broke off, and human bone and tissue was revealed, and they realized it was a real person. But no one knew who this real person was. What happened was they found a ticket inside the body's mouth, and it was to the old sideshow. And what happened is they tracked down the grandson of the sideshow owner, and they found out that this was Elmer McCurdy. And what happened was they then went ahead and took his body to Boot Hill Cemetery, where he was finally given a proper burial. And he was the man that was brought all around the United States as a dead person. So that was the grand tale of Elmer McCurdy. Yeah, very unique. And I think it was very into the kind of genre of Ripley. So I'm glad that I was able to bring that. I actually found out about Elmer McCurdy when Ghost Adventures was investigating Boot Hill Cemetery. And they went ahead and did a big thing on him there. I'm going to talk, just ask your guys' opinions here in a little bit, but I got a couple people on the line. I think I got Hatter on the line. Is that Hatter? Yep. Someone just dropped off. Never mind. I don't know if that's who dropped off or not. But AP Taylor is online. Hey, AP, how you doing?
Hey, JCA, I'm well. I said I would be here, and I am. I actually have written a poem about Elmer McCurdy.
Oh, that is awesome. Why don't you go ahead and read it, and then we will get you some talk of the get comments on your poem and a little bit of opinions on Elmer McCurdy. So go ahead.
Oh, you know, no. It's on the board now, JCA. This is plumber, miner, and train robber. And it goes a bit like this. The $6 million man was filming in Long Beach when a crewman moved what they thought was a dummy. But in moving, they discovered real Bones Leach, and investigations were started on the wax mummy. They found the bandit who wouldn't give up, otherwise known by his name, Nunsu Purdy. This body of a plumber, miner, and thief at SUP, Maine native, Elmer J. McCurdy. After his death, when shot robbing a train, his body was embalmed roughly in wax. And that body, through hands, did wane until found by the crew in Gallows Stacks. For 65 years been moved around, death over only $46 and some booze feared. Finally, to a burial, his body placed into the ground with 2 feet of concrete, so the body never reappeared. End poem.
Oh, my gosh. I am so glad that you put that last part in there. The whole thing about it is they did put 2 feet of concrete on top of his body so no one would ever steal his body again. I love this poem. It is all of what encompasses the story of Elmer McCurdy and encompasses it so well. Like I said, he finally got laid to rest in Boot Hill Cemetery after such a long and unique story. I was very intrigued in his tale as soon as I saw that Ghost Adventures episode where they went to Boot Hill Cemetery and they tried to contact the spirit of Elmer McCurdy. They specifically identified him because of his story and his unique journey after he died. So I think that you encompassed the whole thing quite well, and I really like that. Sweet, what do you think about it?
Well, AP always has to have, you know, flair. And mentioning the $6 million man, just a flare, mentioning 2 feet of concrete. I would have never thought anybody would want to go up and dig up this guy's body again anyway, but I appreciate that. So we have the history. So we have flair and history. We have perfect, you know, cadence and rhyme as always. And I really dug how you put all that together, sir.
Thank you.
This whole thing is kind of fascinating to me that, you know, it was started off this big bang, you know, hey, come see the dead guy. And it just fades in time. Like, I have to say that as I get older, I don't buy things because I look at it and go, who would want this when I'm dead? So if I know nobody's going to want it, I'm not going to keep it. So I'm kind of, this is a prime example as to why, because really, if you hold on to the freak show dead guy, because what's going to happen to it when you die? Well, obviously it ends up in a closet somewhere. And this is just a lesson. Don't buy things or keep things that nobody's going to want when you're dead. But why would you put 2 feet of concrete over it? Who else is going to want him? I'm just baffled by that. And this poor guy. Poor man.
Well, you never know. It was such a unique story. And so you never know what people in their minds would do. You know,
the closet. Was he sitting in somebody's living room, laying around in it? You know, his mind want to know.
Yeah, no, he ended, like I said, he ended up in the Pike amusement park and ended up in their storage area. And that's where they found him hanging up in the storage area.
He was the waxwork dummy in the gallows, JCA. When the crew went in there, they thought that he was just a waxwork, but then somebody shifted him and his arm broke off and they found that it was actually like human.
Exactly. The bone showed.
Who stopped knowing he was a human being? Wait.
That's it. They stopped knowing he was a human being. Yes.
Yep. After a while, after the sideshows, they didn't think he was real. They thought he was a wax dummy. That is exactly what they thought he was.
That embalmer deserves a raise, let me tell you.
What do you think, Rack?
Oh, that's an incredible story from a couple of angles. My brain first goes to the cautionary tale of knowing your craft and how many safe crackers and everything, you know, is teaching somebody or trying to get into it safe or whatever. Now don't overdo it, because we want what's inside to stay intact. And if you use too much, you're going to blow it up. You know, the ineptitude of something like that, or the you know, the lack of foresight. And you know, again, you're supposed to learn from your mistakes, but, you know, he did it more than once. So, you know, that idea, just I love it, because, you know, even to this day, you know, people are talking about when you blow something up, or if you're going to do it, you know, you see on all the movies that you know, when they have the guy breaking into the safe or whatever, sometimes, you know, what's inside, you know, might catch fire or might be blown up, or, you know, so he's got to go in a certain way so that to prevent that from happening. So they take that into account in the storyline. So I think that's fascinating, because it's not something you think of right away. It's like, you know, you've got the barrier and I need to get through this 2 inches of steel. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's like, well, you have to get through the steel, but not through what's, you know, behind it. But as far as AP's poem goes, you know, the journey that this man went on is fascinating, like you said. And I can't help but think, too, you know, in modern times, if this had happened, you know, because we still embalm people and everything. So this could still, someone could just, you know, go in a funeral parlor right now and grab a body and pose it in a scene somewhere. And like, you know, nobody will know until like months later or whatever. It's like, you mean that was real? You know, it's amazing. The detail when they do the embalming and whatnot, that you can, what you can do with, you know, the end result. So that's fascinating as well. And you know, my mind goes through, again, the reason I mentioned modern times, if it happened more recently, he's like, you know, this guy died in 1911, last seen 1945, you know, he went on a tour. He died in 1911. You know, it's documented.
He's almost like the Rolling
Stones. So with the cell phones and everything, you got pictures of him. You know, he was sitting playing. I played poker with that man. You know, they got him sitting at a card table like dogs playing poker. You know, holding a royal flush or you know a full house or something. You know. So the things that you could do with something like that, it's just incredible. It's a fascinating story, like you said. It's really very interesting.
65 years he went and traveled around the United States after he was dead.
Yeah, that's it. And JCA, the thing was that there was a $2,000 reward for him dead or alive after having gone and robbed the train, but he robbed the wrong train.
Yeah,
he robbed
so no.
the passenger train, not the train with the gold and with the currency on it. And so he had a $2,000 bet on his head for getting $46, the watch off the conductor, bottles of whiskey, and a revolver. And that was all he got.
Absolutely. He was one of the last outlaws of the Wild West, but he was also one of the most inept outlaws in the Wild West. For the first train robbery, he blew up the safe so badly it destroyed all of the paper money and then melted the silver coins to the safe itself, and then the bank he tried to rob, he blew up the door of the vault so badly that everything inside the bank vault was destroyed. Yeah, he was
because he caused more damage than what he made off with.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. It's just ironic that he ended up on that journey afterwards. So, yeah, like I said, once again, great way to tell the story there, AP. You got some of the great details contained within it, and I really enjoyed that. Well, AP, are you going to stick around at all, or you got
to
get going?
I have to disappear. It's a business day here, JCA, unfortunately, and so I'm into the business stuff, but I was very pleased to read the story and learn about that. I didn't know about it before, so that was good fun.
I am really glad that you were able to put something about Elmer McCurdy, because I really wanted to work in chronological order here, so thank you so much.
Pleasure, JCA, and we'll talk very soon.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Have fun.
Hey, sweet pea, do you have – who are you going to be writing about? Are you going to read a poem about anybody tonight?
Not anyone in particular. Mine is more about all of it, the mayhem.
Mine is too, so we'll save ours for the end, and that
okay.
will be fine. I know that I know who Hatter wrote for, and hopefully we'll, if he doesn't come in time, we'll read it for him. But this
okay.
next tale is, we're going to talk about the Queen of L.A., Dolly Wallenberger, Dolly Oesterreich. Now, when Dolly was an immigrant from Germany who came in and worked in she worked at a textile mill owned by Fred William Oesterreich. She was 12 years old when she started working there. And by the age of 17, she was in a relationship with the owner of the textile mill, Fred William. And they ended up getting married. This was all in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, they were married for some time. And when she was 33 years old, she was introduced to Otto Sanhuber, which was a 17-year-old sewing machine repairman who worked for her. She asked that she needed her sewing machine fixed and specifically asked for Otto by name to come and fix. What happened was she ended up seducing the 17-year-old and started an affair with him. And what happened is all the neighbors started to get suspicious of Dolly. I'll call her Dolly. That was her nickname. And she explained to them that that was her vagabond half-brother. Fred got suspicious as the neighbors started talking to him. And when he confronted Dolly, she said that he was a salesman and she finally got rid of him. What happened was actually she went ahead and designed a special room in their attic, which had, I believe, an access point from the Wahlberg's closet up into the attic. And there, Otto lived while they were having an affair. So this was back in 1913. And what happened is for the next 5 years, they ended up having an affair in that Milwaukee household. Otto would go nowhere. She would bring him food and a lamp and a plate and a cot to sleep on and some writing utensils as he was writing science fiction novels at the time. And she would bring them to various publishers to try to get them published. I don't know if any of them actually made it to publishing, but ultimately in 1918, Fred Oesterreich told Dolly that they were going to be moving to Los Angeles. And she said she'd agree with it as long as the house that they moved into had an attic. So what happened is that they ended up buying the house, and Otto moved to Los Angeles before the Oesterreichs moved there. And he ended up moving into the attic and creating a secret door that was hidden, a secret hidden door to the house, and he lived in the attic. And they moved in there in 1918, and they continued their affair in that house in Los Angeles. On August 22nd, 1922, the Oesterreichs often had arguments. And Otto would always overhear these arguments. Well, what happened one time in an argument is Otto believed it was so bad that he ran down and he confronted Fred with two pistols. There was a struggle, and Fred was shot, and then Otto fired two more shots, killing him. In a panic, they went ahead and decided to stage a botched burglary. Dolly gave all the money over to Otto and the diamond watch owned by Fred, and he went back up into the attic to hide in his secret room. And he also locked her inside a closet and threw the key. When the cops finally arrived, they suspected Dolly was involved within the murder, but they could not explain how she was locked in the closet, and they did not find Otto in the attic. They could not find the secret door, therefore they didn't know. And they continued to live that way for another 8 years, eight more years. So what happened was Dolly ended up having an affair with her lawyer that she hired when she was being suspected of Fred's murder. And this is where her first mistake happened. In 1930, she ended up giving Herman Shapiro, who was the name of the lawyer, the watch that she gave to Otto that she said was stolen. And he was like, is this not the watch? And she said, oh, the crooks must have dropped it on the lawn. I picked it up and didn't think the police needed to hear about it. And then she turned around and had another lover by the name of Roy Klum. Klum found out about Herman Shapiro, and he went to the police and said, hey, Dolly gave me this pistol to get rid of shortly after the murder and asked to dispose it in the La Brea tar pits. And a neighbor then told the police that Dolly gave him another pistol to dispose of. Well, the police found the two pistols, and they found out that it was the same caliber and arrested Dolly, but they didn't have enough stuff. Well, when she was in jail waiting trial, she told Shapiro that she had a vagabond half-brother living in the attic and requested him to go check on him and bring him food. When he finally checked, Otto answered, and he pretty much gave everything, just went ahead and told Shapiro everything, and the cops were notified, and both of them were arrested. Otto was charged with tried for manslaughter, but they couldn't keep him because the statute of limitations had expired, so he got to go free. And then they tried Dolly, and Dolly, they had a hung jury, so they finally dropped the charges on Dolly, and no one was ever sent to prison for the murder. And that is the story about the lover in the attic. Adder, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Excellent. We have not gone over Mike Malloy yet. We will be doing that next, but I wanted to give the story of Dolly and see what everybody thinks of Dolly, because I think it fits well into the Robert Ripley theme of Believe It or Not. What do you think of the story of the lover in the attic, Hatter?
I've heard that before. I don't know where.
It was a movie.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been a while, but I've heard the particulars of that story before. Pretty bizarre. The kid was only 17 when he first started the affair with her, right?
Yes, he was. Absolutely. She was 33. She was 33. He was 17.
Wow. Unreal.
Yep. She seduced him. And that was the whole thing. But he never argued. He ultimately, how he identified himself was he was Dolly's sex slave. That's how he introduced himself to Shapiro and described himself. So that was quite – she just, made too many mistakes, ultimately was found out. Sweet, what do you think of The Lover in the Attic?
Well, there's a movie out that describes this. I don't know if it's a movie or a short film or something, or I can't remember what I saw it on. But, there's a series called, I know where I saw it now, Greatest Crimes to Remember, and it was there. That has one of those there, and it's great. I think it's insane how much power this woman would have over people. A master manipulator, a narcissist, and not one man, but two men. The man, she kept a boy who eventually became a man that moved across country in a little tiny room to be a sex slave.
I mean, you guys are all men. What did this woman have that lawyers, police officers, a boy that would literally stay in a tiny room and do whatever she said? I just would love to know what manipulation processes she went through that all these just, I shall do what you want, mistress. She fascinates me. She really does. Absolutely fascinating woman. Psychotic and bizarre, but fascinating.
There was a feature film called The Bliss of Mrs. Blossom, which was a British feature film in 1968, as well as two made-for-TV movies in 1995, The Man in the Attic, starring Neil Patrick Harris, and in 1918, Lover in the Attic, starring Molly Burnett. I think you remember the 2017 episode of the series A Crime to Remember.
Yes.
And that's where it was featured as well. Rack, what do you think?
I think I need to get in touch with a couple of architects. I mean, that's kind of cool. You know, I like the idea of you know, the secret door. And you know, it kind of extends a little bit in my brain to a panic room or something like that, because even to this day, you know, when people design, you know, mansions and stuff, if they have the panic room, the door isn't necessarily visible. It's hidden behind a mirror or something. So there's secret rooms that are fortified, you know, again, for a different purpose. But you know, all the way back in the 1900s, they were doing this, and you know, not realizing it was the precursor to something that really people pay a ton of money to have made and put into their houses these days. You know, it's a crazy thought that somebody could get away with doing that too, because my mind first goes to, well, you know, there's no real plumbing up in the attic, is there? So there's a flaw in that plan a little bit, because something's going to build up and become a problem at some point, I think. But, you know, other than that, it's wild to think, like Sweet Pea saying, that somebody would put up with something like that and not go out and see the light of day and just live in this dingy room and be like, you know, bring me my food. I hope I get potatoes today. You know, that kind of what's on the menu? What am I going to have to drink? You know, it's wild not knowing when your next meal is going to come from and essentially being a pet. Like caged like a pet almost. It's wild.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm going to move into the next little story we got. And Hatter, you're going to introduce us to the story of Mike Malloy. So if you want to go ahead and read your poem, and then I will go into Mike Malloy's story.
Okay. Okay, I got to get it. I thought I had it.
I got it. It's on the board right now. I put it there.
Oh, is it? Okay. Come on. No, I'll say peace.
It should be underneath. Maybe you need to refresh it.
Yeah, I need to refresh. Okay, here we are. There it is. Okay. It was titled, How Many Times Do You Need to Try Before You Give It Up? And it goes like this. He tried to kill a man that drank his booze for free. He tried poison, then many shots of antifreeze. Tony failed to kill the man who would try to get, he would try again and again. He made it look like nothing was wrong, and Malloy was his good old friend. I ran him over with my car. I left him to freeze at night one night. That son of a bitch won't die. I need to get it right. Tonight I'll feed him oysters and Jack. That should kill him, they say. But to my surprise, there he was the very next day wanting another drink. What do I have to do to make him go away? I'll hire somebody to take him out. We all heard Tony say, got to be an accident. If they won't pay the money, something needs to happen to him, and it cannot look funny. He finally succeeded, and now he's needed to get paid, just get paid. But questions were asked about the gas and the grave where the victim laid. Too many knew. The cops found a clue. Getaway driver squealed. Tony should have let Mike drink. Maybe he'd make him a deal. Tony died in prison after many, many years, convicted of killing a man for drinking Bud Light beer. Moral of the story, if you walk into a pub to drink, don't order on the side. Remember, Tony owned a bar and the man who would not die.
Oh, I love it. I love it. All right. This is the story of Mike Malloy, the man who wouldn't die. They called him Durable Mike. Now, Mike, as Hatter mentioned, Tony Marino, he owned a speakeasy. And within that speakeasy, him, Joseph Red Murphy, Francis Pasqua, Hershey Green, and Daniel Kreisberg all created this insurance scam where they would go ahead and create false insurances with a crooked insurance agent that would create these fake ones for homeless people. And they would cash in once they died from alcohol poisoning because they would give them unlimited bar tabs. And it kind of worked until they met Mike Malloy. And they went ahead and gave him, this was back in January in 1933, they created a fake life insurance policy beneficiary of Nicholas Melleroy, and it was going to gain $3,500. That is equivalent to $79,000 in 2022 if Malloy died an accidental death. Now, the very funny thing about it is that he wouldn't die. He, for several weeks, they gave him free liquor over and over and over again, but it was starting to cost Marino money. And the health of Malloy actually seemed to be getting better. And he was happier than he ever been getting the free booze. So they had to go ahead and figure stuff out. So Murphy, who was a former chemist, told them that he had some stuff. So they went ahead and put in antifreeze with his shots. Now, the problem is they didn't understand that the alcohol that they were giving Malloy was actually used as an antidote to antifreeze poisoning. So they figured that they would kill him with antifreeze. When that didn't work, they started giving him turpentine shots. When that wasn't work, they gave him horse liniment shots. When that didn't work, they gave him rat poisoning in his alcohol. Problem is alcohol counteracted all those other agents. So, and he kept drinking and drinking and drinking. And it started costing Malloy even more money. So they gave him pure wood alcohol, which was pure methanol, and in an attempt to kill him with that type. But once again, they mixed it in with the other shots, and they counteracted each other. So they went ahead, and then they gave him a story. One of them heard that a guy died from raw oysters, so they went ahead and soaked raw oysters in the wood alcohol, hoping to kill him that way. he liked those oysters so much that he told Marino, hey, you should open up a restaurant. These are so good. So they were like, they didn't know what to think. So what they ended up doing is they ended up giving him a sandwich of rotted sardines mixed with alcohol and tin shaving, the metal tin. And once again, he answered the same exact way as the raw oysters, saying, this is so good. You should definitely add this to the menu of that restaurant you should open up. Then they got sick and tired of it. So they went ahead and took him and pretty much had him drink till he passed out, took him to Claremont Park, stripped off his coat in the middle of winter, threw him in a snowbank and poured 5 gallons of water on him before dumping him in that snowbank. If the liquor poisoning couldn't kill him, then the New York winter would. That's what they thought. The next evening, Malloy showed up wearing a new suit. He explained that he really had wound one up last night, passed out nearly naked in the park. Luckily, the police found him, sent him to a welfare organization that gave him new clothes. After that, they were frustrated, so they hired cabbie Harry Green to run over someone who actually was pretending to be Malloy. They talked to another homeless guy to put all of Malloy's identification on him, and he got run down by the taxi cab. But guess what? This stand-in survived. So after that, they went ahead and, tried it again with Malloy himself. And they ran over them, and they went ahead and were, this time they were sure he was dead because they went ahead and hit him hard. And what happened was nothing appeared in the newspaper. They didn't know where he was. Suddenly, he walks through the door weeks later to the speakeasy, and all he said was, man, I'm thirsty. He was in the hospital recovering with a fractured skull, concussion, and broken shoulder, and he survived the car accident. They were done. They were looking for a professional hitman, but the fee would have been $500, which was way too expensive for how much Malloy already cost them. So they went ahead and said, this is it. They're done. They went ahead and decided murder was the only way. So they once again drunk him till he passed out, took him to one of their apartments, put a hose down his throat, and poured gasoline down his throat, and that finally killed him. What they did is they hired a crooked doctor that went ahead and quickly signed a death certificate and put him in the ground. Well, the problem was is that he had now this reputation of being Durable Mike. And the undercover cops at the speakeasies found out that he died, and they went ahead and turned around and did the investigation, exhumed his body, and found out that Marino went ahead and was killed, or Marino killed them. So what happened was they went ahead and were sent to, four of them were sent to Sing Sing. Let's see, Mike Maloney, Daniel Kreisberg, Tony Maloney, Daniel Kreisberg, and Frank Pasqua, along with Joseph Murphy, were all sent to Sing Sing. Kreisberg, Marino, and Pasqua were sent to Old Sparky, and Murphy, who had his execution stayed, then was later sent to Old Sparky, and they all died the first try. So it was quite ironic how they tried 13 times to finally kill the man, and they were all killed on the first try. And that's the story of Durable Mike. Great poem, Hatter. You grabbed so many aspects of his story, and you portrayed it in a way that we could all see it. I think you did a great job there. Sweet.
Thank you.
What did you think of Hatter's poem and the story of Durable Mike?
I'm really angry they actually killed him. That they had to shove so much gas down his throat. I love the story of this guy. I love dumb criminals. I love that he stood up for so long. And, you know, I love that it cost him a whole lot of money to kill him. It's like a Three Stooges kind of thing. Like, oh, my God, you know, I can't believe it. And one of my favorite parts of the whole story is that the guy they made to look like him and act like him, he didn't die either. So I thought that was a big screw you in your face. So I like him a lot, and I'm kind of sad that he died. But I'm glad that they all got executed. That made me happy. But, yeah, that's a very bizarre story that it takes these hitmen 13 times to try to kill him. And the sardine sandwich thing was disgusting. Obviously had no taste buds. Well, that's from drinking, you know, antifreeze and whiskey and scotch and, you know, rat poisoning together. Yeah, that's just, he had no taste anyway.
Awesome. In 1986, Amazing Stories had an episode called One for the Road, which was a fictionalized version of this story. And then in 2015, an episode of True Nightmares, Season 2, Episode 3, called Friends Like These, told the story of Mike Malloy. And the rock band Primus actually has a song that they released in 1990 off the album Frizzle Fry called You Can't Kill Michael Maloney. So the story still lives on in many other ways. Rack, what do you think of Hatter's poem and the story of Durable Mike? Rack, are you on mute?
Racky, get off mute. He go to sleep. Racky. I don't know where he went.
Is my storytelling putting the people to sleep?
I don't know if anybody else had trouble, but it took me five times to call in.
Yeah.
Is that what's going on in the studio again?
It says he's still on the line. I'm getting messages from people that they are listening to the show and they're hearing the show. So it may be something with the studio itself.
Studio hasn't worked. I didn't get my show in Thursday night because the studio wasn't working. So I had to postpone my show. So that might be why we're not getting a lot of callers, because people can't get in.
No problem. We'll continue on to the next story then. We'll tell the story of the trick-or-treat murder. And this is quite an interesting one, to say the least. It was Halloween 1957. A gentleman by the name of Peter Fabiano, who is the owner of a hair salon, had his doorbell ring at 11 o'clock at night, and he was annoyed because the children in his suburban neighborhood had already collected their treats hours earlier. And so he answered the door, and this tall trick-or-treater with a mask on in a grotesquely painted face and had a domino mask on, in men's clothes, blue jeans, khaki jacket, red gloves. He said, isn't it a little late for this? Isn't it? And the person holding the trick-or-treat bag said no. And inside the trick-or-treat bag, unbeknownst to Peter, was a gun, and he was shot dead. Hearing the shot, Peter's wife, Betty, ran to see what happened, but the perpetrator was already gone in a car that was speeding away, and she ended up calling the police. Now, what was pretty interesting in this was the whole story behind this. Joan Rebel was it was really unknown what her life was, but she met Betty. She was a friend of the families, and actually got into a close friendship with Betty. And Betty was a person, I think they worked together at the salon. And what happened is Betty confided in Joan that Pete, her husband, was abusive and controlling. And Joan ended up obsessing about taking Betty away from there, giving her a whole new life. And it was hard to say what the extent of their relationship was. Then Joan met Goldine. Goldine was a friend of hers, and they would often talk over coffee and everything like that. And what she did is she told Goldine about the Fabianos and described Pete as pure evil. For 3 months, they talked and they had a great friendship. And finally, Joan talked Goldine into being a hit woman, unpaid. And she gave her money to buy a gun and borrowed a getaway car from a friend. On Halloween, she disguised Goldine and sent her to the Fabiano's residence with the gun inside of the trick-or-treat bag, and it took one shot. Joan actually drove the getaway car and dropped Goldine off at her house saying, "Forget you ever knew me." The problem is Joan didn't tell Goldine how to dispose of the pistol. And what happened is that Goldine took the pistol to a Bullock's flagship store in downtown Los Angeles and dumped it in a storage locker. And what happened is I guess someone saw it, and two cops found the gun and questioned Goldine. And Goldine just spilled the beans instantly on what happened. And ultimately, Goldine and Joan ended up being charged with the crime, and they were each sentenced to five years to life in prison. It doesn't say how much time they actually spent in jail. But in the end, Goldine passed away in 1998 in Los Angeles. Betty sold the salon after Pete's death. She got remarried and passed away in 1999. And no one knows what happened to Joan. She just disappeared off the face of the earth. But in ultimately, there was this rumor that Joan and Betty actually had their friendship was more than just friendship, that they actually had a romantic relationship. And that is what sent Joan over the edge. But that right there is the story of the trick-or-treat murder. And I'm going to ask Hatter, what did you think of the trick-or-treat murder?
You know, I must have seen that show because that was another one that was highlighted. I must have watched that show. Didn't she try to make it sound like it was a female at the door?
She tried to make it sound like it was a male at the door, yes.
A male. I'm gonna say, yeah, a male.
Yeah, yeah. She dressed up as a male and everything like that. So, yeah.
Bizarre. Don't answer the door late. It's Richard Trick or Treat.
That was definitely a trick and not a treat. I'm telling you what. Sweet, what did you think of the Trick or Treat murder?
Very interesting. I agree. You don't answer your door on Halloween night after a certain time because generally you're going to get a trick and not a treat. But generally they're not so violent. I got to tell you, this one is scary, only because I think it could happen to anyone. Granted, this is a love triangle and all that, but nowadays, you know, you don't know what's at the door or who's behind the bag or who's behind the mask or anything like that. So this one is a little scary to me. I think it's a little harsher because you never know who might think that they want your husband or your wife or your girlfriend or your child or just maybe your television. It's got a little bit of chilly realism to it.
Absolutely. Let me see. Did we get Rack back or not?
I don't think so.
No. He's still showing up in the studio. That's why.
I know.
And that's fine. That's fine. That we have one more little story to talk about, and this may be the most disturbing one of them all. I think, yes, the trick or treat one is scary, but this one is just crazy. This is the story of Daniel LaPlante, the boy in the wall. And what happened is Daniel LaPlante was living in the 80s. He was living in the 1980s. He was born in 1970 in Townsend, Massachusetts, and had an extremely traumatic childhood. He was abused, especially by his father, whose punishments included physically, emotionally, and sexually abuse. And that's what his troubles were. Every aspect of his life, he struggled with school, academically, socially. He was diagnosed with dyslexia, had very few friends, and he was often referred to as creepy or weird. He was sent to a school psychiatrist, and this was the point where it should have worked to get him better. There was a problem. The psychiatrist ended up taking advantage of Daniel LaPlante. And he, once again, by someone that was supposed to take care of him, turned around and started abusing him over and over again. And in 1980, when he was 15 years old, I believe this is 1985, he started going and breaking into people's homes, and he turned to burglary and stuff like this. But after a while, he not only took possessions, but he left behind things that started messing with people's minds. He didn't say steal the most expensive stuff, the stuff that was worth the most. He would steal stuff that particularly would create something of an emotional attachment to it. Let's say he would take photographs, or he would take, like I said, he would take birth certificates or stuff like that. He would look for stuff that would really affect people. He would take items around their house and move them around and
pretty soon he wasn't stealing anything. And all he would do was move stuff around within everything like that. Now, in 1986, this is where everything went wrong to him. He obtained a phone number of a family's address in the area. Some people think that he broke into this house, and that's how he got the phone number. There was a father and two daughters living there. Tina was 15, Karen was 9, but he ended up talking to them via phone and ended up striking a kind of a phone relationship with Tina. And he said he was good-looking, athletic, blonde, and well-educated. Also lived in the area. After a while, you know, they became acquainted, and Tina agreed to go on the date. When Daniel arrived at their house, Tina was shocked, and she discovered that he was the opposite of what he described. He was not a jock. He was dark-haired. He was greasy and disheveled and had no attractive features whatsoever. Tina said she gave him a chance, and they went to a local fair. An hour into the date, she made an excuse and had to go home. So that was their date. And during the date, Daniel discovered that Tina and Karen's mom had recently died of cancer, and it just fascinated him to all end. And he took a great interest in the mother's death. He kept on asking Tina how it felt when she died. You know, that he continually asked that question over and over again. Tina didn't willingly see, you know, they didn't see themselves after the date again. And here's what happened. One evening, Tina and her sister decided to hold a seance, not knowing what was going on in their basement. And they performed it, you know, teenage naivety and everything like that. They didn't expect anything to come out of it. That evening, Karen and Tina started receiving knocking on their bedroom wall as they slept. They started asking questions, and the knocks would give answers. And they were pretty much convinced that the seance worked, and there were supernatural forces here, and that their mother was talking to them from the grave. This continued for several nights, but the knocking became so regular that it started disturbing the girls. Now, over time, objects in the house seemed to disappear. Items that were on the table were all over the floor. And the girls would come home to find furniture moved from one side of the room to the other. They believed they went ahead and summoned the demon when they were doing the seance, and not their mother after a while. But the father didn't really believe the girls. They believed that he believed that the girls were the one that was causing the problems, and refused to believe, and actually just figured that it was the emotional struggle with their mother. On one evening, strange knocking had begun while those two were alone in the house. At that point, the constant tapping became so commonplace that it was driving them crazy. However, this evening, the noises were not coming from the walls, but they were coming from the basement. So they grabbed a kitchen knife and started down the basement. They crept down the stairs, and they were greeted with a crazy sight. There was blood red on the basement wall with the message, "I'm in your room, come and find me." The girls ran out of the house to a neighbor's and called their father and waited for him to return. But the father once again believed it was the daughters who were doing all of this. And instead of believing them, he sent them to counseling.
several weeks later, a similar incident played out, but this time when the girls entered the basement again, or they went to Tina's bedroom, they were greeted with a message that read, "In blood, I'm back. Find me if you can." It's similar played out, and the girls went to the neighbor's house, and they waited for her dad to come back, and the girls called him from a neighbor's house. He marched straight into the house to prove that there was no one else inside. However, when he got into the house this time, he noticed that everything was moved around differently than what the girls and the neighbor had described was in the house currently, and that someone had been inside the house. He entered Tina's room, and there was an additional message that was painted on the wall that said, "Marry me." Then he looked on the other side, and he saw a young boy standing dressed in clothing of his dead wife, wearing her makeup, a dress, and a blonde wig, and in one of his hands was a hatchet. They struggled for the hatchet, but the boy seemed to disappear. So he called the police up. The police went around, and because it was strange why this boy had disappeared so easily. After it was discovered that the messages were actually written in ketchup, and the police searched the house, and they at first didn't find anything, but then they found this hidden crawl space behind, it's hard to say whether it was behind a cupboard or it was behind the stairs. The officers opened the hatch, and then they discovered Daniel LaPlante curled up inside. They took him into custody and then reevaluated the situation and found that he had been living there for months. And the crawl space went all around the house. He drilled peepholes around the house so he could watch them. And through all this, it was absolutely crazy. So he was 15 years old at the time, 16 years old at the time. He got released, and in October 1987, he ended up committing murder at a different home. When the police investigated the area, they found a similar crawl space in that home and found out that it was very similar to the other house, and they knew, they were pretty sure that it was LaPlante that committed the murder, so they went ahead and looked around, and they went and found him in a dumpster and arrested him. He was tried as an adult and was given 3 life consecutive life sentences. And he would not be eligible for parole in 45 years. He ended up filing a motion because the law changed to say that 16-year-olds could only spend a maximum of 30 years, but the court said his case was not retroactive. He then went ahead and filed for a retrial, saying that it was cruel and unusual punishment in violation of his rights, and this got denied. So he went ahead and sent it to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court went ahead and did not allow him. They did not agree with LaPlante either. And ultimately, he is still in jail, and he will not be released until I think, or he'd not be eligible for release until 2032. That's when he can apply for parole. And that's the story of the boy in the wall. So, sweet. What did you think of Daniel LaPlante's story?
I actually think of all of them, he left the scariest for the last. I mean, can you imagine these young ladies in this house? No one believes them. No one. And they keep having to go back, and they have, keep having to go back. And then there's actually somebody in their house. I mean, the post-traumatic stress that they have to go through. I mean, somebody's been in their house for months crawling around, and they're hearing this, and they're hearing that, and no one believes you. What a sicko. And the fact that he didn't get harsher punishments for this, and then he turned around, and not very long after he's released, he murders someone. That is so scary. God, this one gives me the creeps, totally gives me the creeps, which is why I have four dogs, just FYI. I have four dogs for a reason.
I agree with you. I agree with you totally. Hatter, what do you think?
Yeah, it. What was the guy's? What was the name?
Daniel LaPlante.
LaPlante. You know, was, I got a couple of them confused. The endings. Reading them earlier, I had when I played the little links that you set up.
Yeah,
I thought that was part of the okay, how did it end again? I got
it. It ended. He ended up murdering a pregnant woman and her two kids.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, hiding in the walls. That would be spooky. I guess back in the day, that was easier done with the laugh and plaster walls. But yeah, what a. That's probably why those old Victorians creaked a lot.
Yeah, in 2022, I believe it was the Discovery Channel actually put out a series called Urban Legends, and it was by horror director Eli Roth. And Eli Roth, one of the urban legends was the man living in the wall. And this story right here about Daniel LaPlante is the actual true background to this urban legend. So ultimately, you can say that this is not necessarily an urban legend.
Did they say what kind of house? Was it an older house, or was it
It's really hard to say. I want to say that when you're talking, it was a suburban house. So you're talking in the 1980s. You know, I lived in a house that was built, I think, in 68 or 6. It was, no, 67, I believe, the house was built. And there was, in the stairway, there was this little kind of shelving space going downstairs. And when I was a little kid, I could actually fit into that. It had a crawl space that went to a closet. So you actually had a crawl space in there that actually kind of opened up a little bit, which was kind of the way those houses were built. They had certain areas that you could actually get into, and that was one of them. I mean, we had a cat. The cat would always go up in there, and that was fine. You know, we had no problem with the cat going up in there because the cat would always come out. But, that was actually a place. There was actually several areas like similar to that.
I was an electrician for years, and in Folsom, California, I did the Street of Dreams, wired it up, and my agreement with my boss was, Anything I could sell to the owners, because they were owner builders. Basically, there wasn't any track. They had they built custom houses on these lots, and anything else I could add on to the e-sheet, the electrical sheet, he would split the money with me. These custom homes were built, like you said, there was so much, like in the kitchen, there was an area that through the walls that you could, it would end up under the stair, under the stairs, which were pretty gigantic in itself. But it was, there was a dead space. The only access would have been from the kitchen. So I mentioned that with the owners, and I said this would be a great spot for a little hideaway thing. I have the I got electrical here. I could put in a light. We could put it the you know, the push button locks, or not locks, but the latches. And he agreed. So I started keeping that in mind when I wanted to build my own house. The funny thing is, years and years later, I helped this old guy whose house had burned down on Thanksgiving years before. And it wasn't his house. It was a shop garage with that had already been added on top, a living area. So half of that had burned down. So when I was helping him, I suggested that this is a perfect spot, perfect time to add on some secret places to hide things. And he had a gun collection. He said that would be great. So did live my dream of building a house with secret passages, but it wasn't mine.
Yeah, there's this there's a YouTuber named Flair, and he bought this house, and he created, and he built this house and built it in a custom way where he's got secret openings and everything like that. He's actually got a elevator that will come down inside the garage, and it's also the floor of the loft above. So it brings everything up to the loft, and you can have the storage area up in the loft, and you don't need to bring the stuff through the house. And there's so many different things like that that could, that you could think of. And this was the case in that house, is you had all that area that teenage boy could live in. But it was absolutely a freaky, freaky, scary situation.
Yeah, we did incorporate a dumbwaiter, not quite an elevator to, it could lift a person, but we incorporated a dumbwaiter on one side, which is sort of cool. That was his idea.
Oh, that's awesome. Sweet. Do you want to go ahead and drop your poem down into the board, and we'll listen to this, and because we have reached all of our little tales, and we'll finish with mine and your poems, and in order to go ahead and see us off for the night.
Unmuted.
Sweet, are you muted?
I muted two lines. So if you want to talk about something crazy, you and Hatter can.
Okay, how about I go ahead and I'll read mine first, and then we'll finish with yours.
Okay, that'd be great. I just noticed a big mistake, and now I got to fix it.
No problem. Well, this is a little bit of a summary of all the poems, and also a little tribute to Robert Ripley as we get into Believe It or Not. This is called Murder and Mayhem, Believe It or Not. Daniel is in the walls. Otto is in the attic. Elmer is the sideshow freak, and Mike won't die. Late knock at the door, trick-or-treat at 11, gun in the paper bag, lover down the lane. Drips, dripping drops in the fissures of the brain. Roller coaster derails. Ripley laughs again. End poem.
Wow. Hatter, talk about Mr. Ripley and everything he's done.
It's about the, how do you say that? You know, if you were to live, be part of that scenario in any form, whether you're the widow or the guy that wants somebody dead or the victim, to ends up being a victim, living in, it's like the one, it's like the kid that was 17 years old. He spent how many years living in a flipping attic with a secret door? And as far as,
years,
as far
10,
as,
10 years, 10 years,
10 years. And he, they did say that he had a pot. So to answer what I think you were asking about sweets earlier is like to the using the bathroom. They did say he was given a pot. So I don't know if that was what
chamber.
It was for.
Yep.
Yeah.
But,
I really like how you rounded everything out and kind of touched
it
up for us. And just so you know, I thought this was a hell of a great show. I can't tell you how fun this show has been as far as the stories. A lot of grit and mayhem, but a lot of very interesting things, like so bizarre. I am like in shock about the root, about the guy in the wall. That trick-or-treaters killing people. The other lady who has so much charm and all of those, well, I still can't get over her. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry.
No, it's great. That's the whole, that was the whole concept of what Robert Ripley was about. He wanted you to not be able to wrap your mind around things. He wanted to put out those things that really made you think, oh, did that really happen? What?
Yeah.
How did that happen? You know, it's like, believe it or not. That was the whole concept of believe it or not. And I think that thanks to Robert Ripley, we can have shows like this that make you just scratch your head on how this stuff could have happened.
Absolutely.
Well, in all but one of the stories, there was alcoholism involved.
Well, Malone had a lot of alcohol involved.
Yeah. Trying to drink the guy to death.
Right.
Yeah. Or giving him what counteracts the antifreeze at the same time. Can't figure out why he isn't dead.
Right.
If you get to do with chemistry, you better find out what compounds are, yeah?
No thing. They said one guy was a chemist, but he did not understand the basic principles of what. Well, yeah, he was a lousy chemist, just like that one other guy was a lousy bank robber or train robber. So, yeah. All right. Here we go. Sweet.
What
Why the
hell
don't you send
is going
us
on?
Up?
All right. Yeah. This is what the hell is going on? Narcissistic tendencies. Female sensuality, come hither eyes, takes a plethora of men and boys by ultimate surprise. There they take a tiny bite, and the poison fills their throats. Forever now, she has one more man in her court. Sewing machines and high school boys were your dreams, forced to hide in secret rooms, hatching murderous schemes. Love makes us do the strangest things. Ask her lovers, 1, 2, 3, even in death. Her hands stayed clean. Shots lined up on the bar, mixed in his alcohol, whiskey meets antifreeze, scotch and rat poison, he licks his lips. Taxi cabs and people tricks cannot kill this beast. Time to deal with this demigod, gasoline by the gallon poured in his mouth. His final curtain call. Police found and chained up the chumps, heat up the electric chair, and flip the switch. Time to fry some lunatics. Trick or treat, that girl is mine. Keep your candies and chocolates fine. Set under the porch light, a delight I find. Now, can I sell this gun at a five and dime? I guess a trash can will be just fine. Now, strangers see strange things and call the cops. Found and you're alone. Alvis sings Jailhouse Rock. As the blues overwhelm you in a prison smock. A little boy in walls you crawl, tortured girls at your call. Non-believers, let them Let them bleed until one day daddy fights your evil seed. Now in nightmares do these ladies scream. Left to play on your own, couldn't keep yourself at home. Bloodlust crawled into your brain. Now three are dead, and may you rot in tremendous pain. One more nod to a man on a train. Partied hard until the day he was found. End poem.
Oh, I love this. I love this because it told the tales and brought it to a screeching halt. And I like each little way that you played into each of these stories because it was so neat. You said that Dolly pretty much stayed clean, and she did, unfortunately. They said she got married again and ultimately just died a free woman. Didn't have to pay for anything she did, which was sad. And then I like that you heat up the electric chair. That was probably the electric chair in Sing Sing prison was probably the most famous electric chair ever created. They called it Old Sparky, and Old Sparky took out those people that killed Mike Malloy, and I love how you put that. You brought the 1950s into it with Jailhouse Rock. I love that. And everything about Daniel and Elmer were brought into it as well. You know, I think you did well. This was great. This was a great way to end this show. Hatter, what did you think about Sweet's poem there at the end?
Yeah, it was very, very well written, very informative. I think the kid that lived in the walls, I'd like to know because that was early 1900s, if I remember right.
No, that was the 1980s.
That was 1980s.
No. I'm talking about Otto. Otto and Sally.
One that lived in the attic was 1920s.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be unseen, unheard, there's no TV. Everything creaked in those houses. I wonder what he must have been a shadow. He must have learned how to be quiet, moving around, because, like, what do you do all day? I mean, I know guy was at work most of the time, but there must have been days.
Let me tell you what he did all day. He did all the housework. He cooked the food. He did everything around the house.
And this is why it's so fascinating to me, because this is a woman in the 1800s having men fawn, do everything for her, money, gifts, jewelry, housework. She doesn't have just one. She has lover after lover after lover.
They didn't shave their legs back then, did they?
Rack is back. Rack is back. I know he is.
I mean, that's what fascinates me. This is not a time where women were bold and outgoing, and she's just lining them up like, hey, I got my shit together. And
yeah, this was the 1920s. This was the 20s, roaring 20s, in the start of the flapper movement. So
we should research what Dolly had.
Yeah, I would like to know.
She had something.
She had
her husband's money. She had her husband's money.
I guess.
Rack, did you get to hear either of the last two poems? I think you heard Sweets.
I heard the tail end of her piece. A summary of a lot of the stories that you told tonight, which was fantastic. You know, and she's great when she gets on a roll. She'll describe stuff. I don't need to tell you guys. You know, it's always lovely to hear her. You know, summarize things and bring in Elvis, and she always manages to get something a little unexpected, and she has a sense of humor about it, and you know there's even a hint of childish wonder sometimes, because like she says, you look at these things and you have to ask the question,
it's like, how did they get away with that? Why did it work for them? Why can't I do that? Why can't I snap my fingers and have someone climb out of the attic and cook my food and do my dishes and then go disappear?
Go back to the room, slave. I'm done with you.
That's about what it was. You know, when you think about it, that is exactly what it was. That's why he called himself.
I may not come to you tonight and give you presents, but I don't know. I mean,
I'm her sex slave. That's how he described himself, as a sex
right.
slave.
And she got away with it. You know, it's not that other people didn't do it. It's that she got away scot-free.
And the thing that blew my mind is after the husband died, he lived in the attic for another 8 years. The only thing different, they said, is he was given a typewriter so he could actually make noise up there.
Oh, no, he started writing, didn't he? Didn't he start writing?
He started writing in the other place. He was given a pen and paper.
Yeah.
When they lived in Milwaukee, and she would actually shop around his science fiction story.
But he was a poet.
Hatter, you're funny.
Yeah, he was a science fiction writer, and she tried to get his work to publishers. I don't know if any of his stuff got produced at all. I meant published at all. But he wrote science fiction stories.
We should see what they're like. I wonder if there's any copies of it. I bet he was a rhymer.
Unlike
you. That's a great question. Let me see. Let me look it up right now. Otto Sandhuber. You burr.
Check the classic section on all poetry.
Hey,
yeah,
Adam.
Yeah.
How many of my lines did you want to go back and rhyme?
That second part. I go, wait.
I knew you were.
See, I don't know if you ever get asked. If you do a web search on him, all that's going to come up is Dolly,
yeah.
the man in the attic, the man in the attic. That's all that will come up. You will not be able to get past that in the Google search. So I don't know
what
if you'll ever find it.
Did they mention
I don't
the
think
publisher?
Any of the. No, I don't think any of them got picked up. I'll be honest with you. After what happened, it was like. No, she shopped it around to publishers, but I don't think any of the publishers picked it up.
Oh, okay.
But once the media picked up, it was a circus. Everything happened. They found that out. It was one of the most publicized crimes in American history.
How could it not be? She's a woman who could really vote, and she's got men in the closet. Not only has she had men in the closet, he moved them across country. He moved across, went from one room in a house, moved across country, and decided to move in another house.
It's mind blowing. It is absolutely stinking mind blowing. I agree. That's why all of these stories fit so well in the genre of Robert Ripley, because they're so unbelievable. They're hard to believe. It is believe it or. Not.
I wonder if she had a basement.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I wonder if she had a basement, too.
The older houses here in Wisconsin do have basements, so there's a good chance, but usually those basements have dirt bottoms. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's questionable. With that, I'm gonna give everybody a chance to put in a little closing statement, and then we're gonna call it a show. Rack, is there anything you'd like to add or let everybody know?
I had a good time, believe it or not.
That's awesome. Hatter.
Well, I'd say beware of your surroundings or you'll end up on some poetry show. Losing the walls.
Awesome. Sweet, you want to add anything else?
Check out my show for Thursday night. Hopefully the studio is up and running. It is some wild bird, wild pictures. The winners of the 2023 humorous nature photos. They are hilarious. I guarantee you will enjoy them.
Thursday.
Awesome. Thursday. So here's what we're I'm very excited because in 2 weeks, we're going to go into the 2000s. If you thought those other stories were absolutely crazy, you just wait. I have found some amazing stuff for the next show, and it's going to be just as crazy. So I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. It was absolutely awesome. I'm glad I was able to share these crazy stories with you. And I know this is a little different for Blog Talk Poetry, but I'm very thankful to have this where we're able to talk freely about these type of these type of stories. It's absolutely a blast. Remember to celebrate Ripley's Believe It or Not, 19th of December. Thank you, Robert Ripley, for all that you did, all that you put into place, and we're excited to continue on this journey in 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody, for taking place, people around the world for listening in. Thanks, AP, for calling in, and each of you, Rack and Hatter, Sweet Pea, another awesome night of co-hosting. Thank you very much. Yeah. And with that, I'm going to say good night.
Good night, everybody. Have a good
day.
Bye.
See you in your dreams.
Yep. Take care.